This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. Had the air on this morning when I was driving in. It's a gorgeous day. It's a gorgeous day today. Just a tad on the cool side, but man, the sun is out. It's beautiful. Spring maybe is coming, which it's lovely, lovely, lovely. I had a chance to kind of walk back and forth between the main buildings at my main client today, because I had some meetings and things I had to go to, and it really was lovely outside. Anyway, so all is well. Things are puttering along. We've got a beta release coming up for a new financial reporting website. That should be coming up in a couple of weeks once we get through close of March. So in about 2 weeks, and looks like everything's on target for that. We're just going to throw it open to all the clients and see what happens. We've done a limited beta release already to internal and some externals, and that all seemed to go fine. We got some good input, and so we're just hammering down the final details, but we are just very, very close to being ready, and we're about 2 weeks ahead of schedule, so that's good. In the meantime, I've been having meetings, doing some deep analysis on some other pieces that we're going to start building. So that's all going along fine. Everybody seems to be happy, you know, understanding the work that's being done and what's been done and what's coming up. And so it's good. It's good. Life is good. I've been just puttering along writing. I'm somewhere around 22,000 words, I think, somewhere around on the new book. This is going to be very interesting to see. Just going to be very interesting to see how this all works out, because I don't know if I'm going to have any beta readers by the time this is all said and done. It's just such a long haul. But that's okay. You know, it's okay. And it's interesting because I have typically had a fairly, in terms of sentences and paragraphs, I've typically had a fairly terse style where I break up stuff maybe down more than the normal writer would do that. And, you know, I haven't really gotten that many comments of that. It's just the way I had been writing. And so last time, one of my beta readers, he was new, first time he'd ever read anything by me. He said, "The only thing I will say is," he said, "your paragraphs are really short." And he said, you know, it was distracting for me. So I thought, well, you know, I could make my paragraphs a little longer. I think I kind of overdid it, because I had some rambling paragraphs in this last book. So I had another of my beta readers say, yeah, some of the paragraphs are like really long and long sentences. Like, oops, sorry, I kind of overdid that. I'll see if we can't find a happy medium here. And I don't think I was quite in my flashback section that there is in the first chapter. I didn't quite explain that well enough. And so, you know, there's a few little things, tweaks. And I think the big thing really is that this particular book is just longer, because it's 450 pages as opposed to 350 pages. And I really need to keep these books down in the under 400 page range. You know, I really need to get these things landed like at 375 or something like that, because when you pick up the second book after having the first book, it's like, whoa, this is heavier. And of course that, you know, can discourage some people from getting started reading. I'm going to do my best to be less verbose in this one. In fact, the storyline that I'm working on, I'm looking at it going, is this going to be enough? But of course, it always turns into enough. It's one of those amazing things that you start, and then by the time you get everybody's reactions and their philosophies and their feelings and what they're thinking, and you know, it just, the book gets big. It gets big fast. It's always fascinating to me to watch it unfold. I think it was last week or the week before last. Week before last, maybe. We had a dinner at church, and there was a young lady there who's one of my beta readers, and you know, she was saying, "Do you ever get writer's block?" She said, "I'm amazed how quickly you put these books out." And I said, "No, not usually." I said, "It's like a movie, you know. You get the characters out, and it's like a movie that I can move around, you know. But there's always something else to do. There's always a different place to go." And just last night, I was tired. I had been fasting, and so I got to my target, but I've been trying to go above target, and I didn't make that last night, and I didn't make it Monday night either. I was just a little tireder, and I was reworking some sections that were a little harder pull. And then Tuesday, I didn't get any writing done at all because I went out with a buddy, and by the time I get home from that, it's like 7 o'clock, and then by the time I get settled in and get exercised, especially if it's a big yoga routine, it was 8:45 before I was ready to sit down, and I usually knock off about 9 o'clock on Tuesdays and Thursdays just to go up and watch some TV with my wife and chat and that kind of thing. So just didn't get anything done on Monday, which, of course, throws me really, really late. But I had gotten 2,500 words done on Sunday, which the schedule only calls for 1,000, so that puts me way ahead. But I would still like to get to 7,500 words this week, because if I can get to 7,500 as opposed to 5,000 every week, I can get done faster. I mean, if the target is to land somewhere around 110, 115, somewhere in there, you know, at 7,500 a week, I can get to that 115 in what, 12, 13, 14 weeks or so, which is 4 months instead of 5 months. And then that means I've got extra time to work on the cover and, you know, get back on track with my schedule. And so there's a lot of benefits if I can keep it to 125,000 words as opposed to 150 or maybe 110,000 words, and I can do 7,500 words a week. So we'll see. I'd love to be able to get to the place that Anthony Trollope was, where he was doing 2,500 words a day in 3 hours, which is, that is amazing. 2,500 words in 3 hours. He was doing 250 words every 15 minutes. He was cranking. And I have hit that before when it's a big, exciting action passage and I just have to hammer it down. But I always go back and spend, you know, not a trivial amount of time editing that back up, because even though it's flowing, it flows too fast. And then I get back to it and it's like, oh yeah, okay, I gotta make that breathe a little more, I gotta extend that, I gotta round out that description. So, but it's really fascinating, because last night I had, at least to me, last night I had kind of got to a stopping place, and I didn't actually know what was coming next, and I was like, what? But it was right time to quit, so I went ahead and quit, go to bed. And I was laying in bed this morning, and I was thinking about it. I was thinking about what the characters might do, and I was like, oh yeah, in that instance, that character might do this, and that gave him an excuse to go talk to another character he's really been needing to talk to, and so I thought, well, there's a scene right there, and so it's fun, and that will get me, I think, to the end of the chapter, and then I really don't have any boost at the end of the chapter, that I gotta figure out what that is. Because I'm within 3 or 4 pages of the end of the chapter, which means I can flex to 4 or 5 pages easily if I want to do, you know, something new, or if I want to extend out this interview that's coming up between these two. If I can find something odd to stick in there, then, you know, maybe I can make that work too. So we'll see. I'll get started writing on it tonight. Thursdays is typically not a heavy writing night because I have to upload the podcast, take care of that stuff, and then do yoga, and then by that time it's usually all I have is an hour. But it's coming along. This is going to be to me a fascinating journey and a fascinating effort. And honestly, one of the real reasons, at least for me, to continue doing these podcasts is simply to kind of document where I am in this process so that later, maybe, you know, after it's all said and done, I can see where it went off the rails. But to that end, the conversation that I'm talking about happens in book 3, which at this point is called The Narrow Door. And it's part of the, I've forgotten the name for it, exposition, there it is, getting old. It's part of the exposition of the first several chapters, and it's a conversation between Oakford and Merck, just for referencing for myself later. And I'll probably start doing that in the coming podcast, that I just leave reference notes for myself. Because at some point, we are going to have routines that can listen to a person and actually accurately write out what they say. So anyways, lots of things to talk about, lots of things going on. Grandkids are good. Kids are good. I am so grateful that I am not in charge of an organization with what is facing organizations coming up, because right at this time in Springfield, there is an ordinance that the city council passed, and it equated gays and lesbians as a protected group, and transsexuals and transgendered people as a protected group in the same way people are classified by race. And so by doing that, that means that business owners cannot deny employment based on homosexuality. They cannot deny employment based on transgender or transsexual orientations. It's a very interesting time to be a business owner. They cannot deny access to public accommodations based on that. So if you've got someone who is transgendered, if a guy puts on a dress and claims to be transgendered, that they cannot be denied from going into the women's bathroom. Lots and lots of really interesting issues. And what's fascinating to me about this is the response that the organized church has had to this, and the ramifications that there's going to be for that. This is a fascinating time. And frankly, it's fascinating enough, and I have odd enough opinions on it that I'm just basically keeping my mouth shut when it comes to having discussions with anyone who would not know me well enough to keep their mouths shut about what I'm saying. And it's especially fascinating because my son-in-law is the lead pastor now at Praise Assembly, and he has his own opinions as to what should be discussed and done about this. And he is his own man. And so I am absolutely not going to be trying to influence him, because this is his decision, and this is his quest and his epic. And this is what he has lived for, to come to this place where he is leading a congregation. And it's a challenge. It is a challenge. And it's a fascinating challenge. So I'm probably not going to be talking about that at all on the podcast, simply because I don't want to go on record about my opinions on those things. Because it's not profitable for me to do so. But it is a really fascinating time, and I want to document at least the fact that I saw this was a fascinating time, and it's going to be really interesting to see how this develops out in the next 5 years, and to see how this plays out, because I have very definite opinions about how the Church of Jesus Christ should conduct themselves in this situation. But I very much recognize that how the organized church might want to conduct themselves might be at odds with that. So, anyways, that's all I'll say about that. It is episode 313. My kids were very kind last week to participate with me. My wife would have been there as well, but she had forgotten it was coming up. I had stayed up till 5:30 in the morning working on some things for the church, and she was just wiped. She had gotten out of bed when she realized that I was heading down to their house to do this. She had gotten out of bed and was trying to get ready, and I said, "Sweetie, just go back to bed." "Well, I told you I'd do that." I said, "Sweetie, go back to bed." So she went in and just went back to bed. So that was fine. And I should have mentioned that last week, but I didn't. Anyways, this week on a TED Talk that I had watched, which was a really fascinating TED Talk, because I knew what was coming, and when we got there, there was the atheist evolutionary side shuffle that the lecturer went through, that, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain type of a thing. So this is always fascinating for me to see this, and to watch the language that is used, and to watch the soft dance that people do around the issue. This particular TED Talk was dealing with entropy and reverse entropy, the increase of complexity. And the lecturer had titled his talk, it was David Christian, entitled his talk, "The History of Our World in 18 Minutes." And it was really the history of the universe in 18 minutes. And he was trying to make an argument for one of the things that seems odd about the whole structure of the universe. And that is that there is a generally accepted principle of entropy, that things become more chaotic, and yet when we look around our existence, we see the increasing complexity of our world. How can this be? And so he was attempting to explain this. And he began his talk by showing a videotape of eggs being scrambled, except they were being scrambled backwards. So you saw the eggs moving into a more organized state with the oaks and the yolks and the white, the oaks and the yites, the oaks and the whites, and then eventually leaping up into the shells and ta-da, you know, nothing in the bowl. And he said, obviously this looks odd to us because we recognize this general idea of entropy in the world. I'm getting my mail, one moment. And in fact, there is a law, you know, and it is the second law of thermodynamics that indicates that things should be moving to a generally more disordered state. Wow, I have the window rolled down, and it's just, it's a gorgeous day. It's just beautiful. Maybe I'll go walking this weekend with my buddy and get outside. That would be fabulous. So he said, and yet as we look around us, there is this staggering complexity. He named a guy named Eric Beinhacker or Beinhacker, and he estimates that in New York City alone, there are some 10 billion SKUs, stock keeping unit, that stands for, distinct commodities that are being traded. Billion with a B, just in New York City alone. And so the puzzle is if the universe is really run by entropy, then how in the world have we developed this sort of complexity? And he said, what you have is you have pockets. I'm backing into my garage one moment. Said you have these pockets where resources are not evenly distributed, and you can have more resources in certain pockets. And because those resources are there and they are concentrated there and you have excess energies there, that you can actually have short-term an increase in complexity. And in fact, you can have something, you know, he said, well, it's each stage, complexity builds in this stage by stage. And he said, you know, each stage is magical, he said, because it creates this impression of something utterly new appearing almost out of nowhere in the universe. So, and obviously, this is the explanation for how it could be that things arise basically without a designer. One moment, I'm just going to wave at the garage door opener so that it turns on the light. Because we have a new garage door opener that turns on the light. So I get a little light in here so I can see my notes. And so, you know, he said we refer to these moments, these big history to these moments as threshold moments. At each threshold, the going gets tougher, the complex things get more fragile, more vulnerable, the Goldilocks conditions become just more stringent, and it's more difficult to create complexity. I'm listening to all this and I'm going, okay, let's hear what you have to say. So he went through, you know, the Big Bang. Of course, there's no explanation for how the Big Bang occurred. We assume we're going to figure out that in the future, but there was nothing and then there was something. And most of it was just hydrogen, but then there were pockets where there was more concentration. They began to coalesce. Eventually, fusion starts up, you know, and then you eventually get stars and they go to supernovas and they die. And in the process of going to supernovas, they create complex chemicals. You know, and it fuse larger and larger molecules towards the end of their life. I mean, the time spans that we're talking about here are mind-boggling. They're just mind-boggling. So when these very large stars die, they create temperatures so high that protons begin to fuse in all sorts of exotic combinations to form all the elements of the periodic table. Okay, if you wear a gold ring, that was forged in a supernova explosion, he says. So, okay, so eventually you get these other particles that are created, and over these huge stretches of time, things begin to coalesce into these accretion disks, and eventually we begin to form planets, the planets get formed, blah, 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 blah. He said, now the going gets tougher. The next stage introduces entities that are significantly more fragile, significantly more vulnerable, but they are also more creative and much more capable of generating further complexities. I'm, of course, talking about living organisms. And then my ear picks up because I've been waiting. I've been waiting for him to get to this spot. because I just want to hear what the present day common wisdom is for how we got life started, because this is a big bugaboo. How do you go from a bunch of chemicals to life as we know it? And he makes the statement, which I think is a fully unsupported statement and has connotations in it, which people latch onto that are not necessarily supportable yet because there's been no direct evidence that this actually happens. He says, living organisms are created by chemistry. Okay, well, that's true once you have life going and once you have organisms going. It has yet to be proven that you can actually take a bag of chemicals and shake it around enough in a pool of water to create what needs to be created to keep organisms going. And he said, we are huge packages of chemicals. So chemistry is dominated by the electromagnetic force that operates over smaller scales than gravity, which explains why you and I are smaller than stars or planets. Okay, that's fine. Now, what are the ideal conditions for chemistry? What are the Goldilocks conditions? Well, first, you need energy, but not too much. In the center of a star, there's so much energy that any atoms that combine will just get busted apart again, but not too little. In intergalactic space, there's so little energy that atoms can't combine. What you want is just the right amount, and planets, it turns out, are just right because they're close to stars, but not too close. But not all planets. This is my addendum. Only certain planets that are in the Goldilocks zone. And not all planets yet, because if all you have is a rocky exterior, that ain't going to do it any either, he said, because you need a great diversity of chemical elements and you need liquids such as water. Why? Because in gases, the atoms move too fast. In solids, they move too slow. You've got to have water in this theory for things to slosh against each other and try to get combined. And he said, but of course, life is more complex than just exotic chemistry. How do you stabilize those large molecules that seem to be viable? And my ears pick up again. It's like, well, right. So now where are you going? So he said, well, it's here. His quote, well, it's here that life introduces an entirely new trick. Oh, life introduces a new trick. Except at this point, life doesn't exist. There is no DNA. There's only a bag of chemicals. So where does life come up with this trick? And how does life manage it? And the simple answer is life doesn't manage it. And all we're doing is we're just taking a word and substituting it for a designer so that we don't have to face the designer and we can just make it this amorphous force that just somehow magically things happened. And he says, I'm getting back to his quote, you don't stabilize the individual, you stabilize the template. The thing that carries the information that you allow that, and you allow the template to copy itself. Oh, this is very interesting. And of course, the template is DNA. And he said, and DNA, of course, is the beautiful molecule that contains that information. Okay, wait. Time out. So now you have a chicken and an egg problem. Because for something to make DNA, you have to have very sophisticated molecular machinery. For something to replicate DNA, you need very sophisticated molecular machinery. And if somehow, by some chance, you manage to juggle all these chemicals together and get them to form in this template that somehow managed to have exactly the programming that you need to create these beautiful cells that do these amazing things, even if you're only down at the one cell level, that do these amazing things that allow it to ingest and excrete and reproduce itself. This completely complex, beautiful script, even if you managed to put all these chemicals together to create this script, if you didn't have the thing that interprets that script, you got squat. You got nothing. Because all that's going to happen is that script is going to bounce along until something collides with it and rips it apart. It's a huge chicken and an egg problem. But people just make these bolts. Oh, yeah, well, yeah, all these chemicals, they just got together in DNA. There, we're done. Thank you very much. And then somehow, cells formed. They could use the DNA. It was real convenient. So from there on out, you know, okay, fine. You know, there's still some problems. Like, okay, so you managed to get a single cell organism. And he said, you know, you start these single cells. And he said they, about 600, 800 million years. And then all of a sudden, you have the Cambrian explosion, it's called. And in the Cambrian explosion, all these animals get produced. All this diversity gets produced. Poof. Don't really have an explanation for that either. And then, you know, he eventually got down to humans. But what's interesting is once he got down to humans, he really didn't mention the human accelerated regions either, which are regions that are fundamentally different. You know, we say that we share DNA. 99% of our DNA is shared with chimpanzees. Okay, well, that's true. But that other 1% is incredibly important. And for want of a better term, the scientists simply call them HAR. Like the pirates. HAR, human accelerated regions, where things just went crazy. And everything fell into place to give us the capacities that we have in terms of brain matter and language and intelligence and all those things that truly do separate us from the animal kingdom. Maybe not structurally, but in terms of what we are capable of, because there is no other race on this planet that can do what we do. And we are orders of magnitude better at it. It's not that we're an incremental improvement. We are a giant leap, as evidenced by the complexity that we have introduced into the world. Not all of which is good, understandable. But we are amazing, wonderfully and fearfully made, the psalmist says. And I see no evidence as yet in science to contradict the idea that there is a designer. And even if we proved that our universe really does prefer life, and it really does have this magical quality of creating life every chance it gets, even that does not preclude a designer. Just like evolution, the mechanisms of evolution do not preclude a designer, which is why I have said in the past, and I continue to this day, that one said, well, think, when people say, well, and things evolved because, you know, because of evolution, I just substitute, well, things were designed for adaptation and therefore they adapted. Because the designer that we have really is that good. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.